start the subcommittee of the subcommittee, if we could, on the general government ways and means, joint ways and means. And we'd like to invite Mr. Goodell, if he would come forward, please. And we'll spend just a few moments on the substantive bills that have been basically worked. The two bills are 2020 and 2057. And we'd like to go ahead and open now this public session on 2020 and 2057 so that you could give testimony as to those two bills before we move to a work session and move into those.
Chair Butler, members of the committee, I'm Ken Cudell, Administrator of Construction Contractors Board. HUC Bill 2020 is a bill that will require contractors, new contractors, to pass an examination based upon 16 hours of training, which is now part of the law. They have to take the 16 hours of classroom training. This law would require that those people pass an examination on those 16 hours, and it would also change the term registration to licensing at the same time.
Now, there was originally an impact, a fiscal impact, Mr. Cadell has estimated for the current biennium of $162,772 with a three-quarter FTG for the current biennium. Can you address that issue for us, please?
Looking at what this is, the typical happening on a typical year is about 7,000 people will become contractors in Oregon. That same year, about 6,000 will go out of business with a net gain of about 1,000. But developing a test, administering the test, and then processing the necessary paper associated with that, we're looking at having the test developed by people that do that sort of thing. And as it would turn out, the board a few months ago joined the National Association of State Contractor Licensing Agencies, and one of the chief sponsors of that are people that do develop tests. So we've learned some information about that, and their information back to me is to develop this from scratch is the biggest part of this cost. The cost of that initially, we're looking at $100,000 to develop the test. We're looking at updating of that and keeping it current in future bienniums, $20,000 to develop that, or to keep it current, to maintain the test bank and the test program. And we're looking at one FTE of office specialist, of clerical person, to process the paper, and that's the total impact in this case.
And relative to 2057, did that in part deal with some of the education issues,
So 2057 contains a number of things, only one part of which is a fiscal impact, but it does. 2057, the section of it that contains the impact is section 8, which on my bill is on page 7 of the bill. And what it does, it allows the Construction Contractors Board to place on probation a contractor if they receive three or more claims against the contractor within a 12-month period. You can't put them on probation until we've done some kind of investigation to determine that there's some validity to the claims. And the contractor could then be given a period of time to clean it up or lose their registration. And one of the things that we could do with this, which would tie it back to 2020, is if it's a contractor, one of the things that could be part of the correction would be for them to go back and take that 12-hour or 16-hour and pass that exam.
In 2057, there was an issue dealing with moral turpitude, as I understand it. Has that that issue is still outstanding, how will they be able to get their bonds if there's an issue of moral turpitude outstanding against a contractor? Was that addressed as you discussed the fiscal impacts of that?
Chair Butler, that's in section 4 of the bill, and we've gotten rid of the words moral turpitude and actually listed certain crimes. And this was more acceptable to the people to know exactly what we had. So there are two things that protect us. Is first off, it's these crimes that are listed here on page 4 of the bill. And then also, in ORS 670.280, there's some provision in there that basically says that it has to be something relevant to this line of work. So it has to be relevant to the work of a contractor. So conceivably, somebody could have committed one of these crimes, and unless we can show that it relates to today, to that person being a contractor, and it's necessary to protect the citizens of the state, we wouldn't deny or take away their registration for that.
But as to the bonding, will they have difficulty obtaining a bond with the list of crimes that have been included here?
Sure, Butler, I think that what a bond company would be the best one to answer this, but basically what a bond company is looking at, are they worth a loan of $10,000 or $15,000? I don't know that they're doing that kind of a check on them. They would be getting an assignment of something from them, but if they've got assets exceeding the amount of the bond that they can tie, then they'll write the bond. I don't think that they check for these kinds of crimes.
So the majority of the bond issues are in effect collateralized bonds anyway, so they're not. It isn't an issue because we have addressed higher bond limits discussed and actually I think passed some higher bonding limits and the concern now with regard to allowing folks to have some sort of a history, a criminal history involved here to become bonded. I guess as long as they can become bonded, then that should address the issue.
That's correct. We also have another way of knowing today we are tied in with issues from some other states through the National Association of State Contractor Licensing Agencies. We have a bank of people who have been, whose registration or license has been revoked in a given state, and we have access to that. So we have some information from across lines when people are moving about. And we don't look at this as being a provision we use very often.
Okay. I would hope not, because but I'm sure that you've worked it, and the substantive portions of these bills have all already hit committee. And so I guess the final question that I would have relative to the public session dealing with 2057 and 2020 is that the fiscal impacts of 2057 estimated to be approximately $117,000 and the fiscal impact of 2020 estimated to be nearly $163,000. Have those been resolved to your satisfaction incorporated within the confines of House Bill 5036 dealing with the total package?
Yes, they have.
Okay. Okay. We don't have enough to go into work session yet. Maybe we were dealing with this issue out of or in work session before we closed up and ran out of time last time. I think Robin was taking us down to an issue of a budget note.
I believe we could discuss that.
I think we could discuss the budget note as long as we don't resolve any language on it.
Yeah.
Which page, Robin?
It's, I didn't put page numbers on this, but it is on
page
3 of my recommendation.
All right.
And I don't know that, could we open a public hearing on this on 5036? We might need to do that.
Okay. I don't believe that we actually did, so let's go ahead and we'll continue with 2020 and 2057 because they deal with that. We'll open the subcommittee, of general government on 2036 as well, so that we can discuss the some of the issues and how the other two bills flow in. And
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if you recall on Friday, we were discussing eliminating funding through this budget for the State Police Construction Fraud Unit, and I said I would come back with a recommendation, and what you have in front of you is a budget note, a proposed budget note, which directs the construction contractors to develop a plan to increase investigative activities related to construction crimes and malfeasance. In developing this plan, the board will specifically address compliance with the provisions of ORS 701-290, which I attached, which is the statutory provision that requires the Construction Contractors Board and the Oregon State Police to address fraud in the construction industry.
There are no provisions in 701.290 that deal with the contractual or financial arrangement between the two parties, though, is there?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's absolutely correct. It instructs them to establish an intergovernmental agreement, but contains nothing having to do with how that unit would be funded. The budget note says that the board will specifically address compliance with the provisions of ORS 701-290 related to the intergovernmental agreement and statutorily mandated ongoing relationship with the Oregon State Police, including a process to monitor referrals and track and report on outcomes, including convictions from the referrals. Mechanisms to increase referrals to local law enforcement agencies, including a process to monitor referrals and track and report on outcomes, including convictions from the referrals. Mechanisms to increase the involvement of the Attorney General, including a process to monitor referrals and track and report on outcomes, including convictions from the referrals. Statewide investigator assignments, including provisions to ensure proportional investigator contracts in all parts of the state, and a plan to address the impact of construction crimes and malfeasance on vulnerable Oregon residents, including the elderly. This plan should include a process to identify vulnerable populations, to monitor and refer incidents of construction fraud and crimes against these populations, and to track and report on the outcomes, including convictions involving these populations. The board will develop an expenditure plan for these expanded investigative activities and will request additional limitations from the emergency board when the plan is developed. The board will report to the emergency board quarterly on the specific components of this investigative plan, including referrals and outcomes.
Mr. Cadell, would you like to respond to the proposal in that particular language?
Sure, Brother. I'm not quite sure how to respond to it. It certainly covers the issues of what needs to be done. We need to track what happens. One word that isn't in there any place has to do with more consumer education, and we would plan to do that as part of it also. It seems to me that the elderly population, particularly, we need to do more in the way of educating them to avoid fraud.
In a previous portion of the budget, didn't we talk about consumer education?
Chair Butler, it's not part of any improvements that we're looking at making into the system, and I'm not sure that is something that requires an expenditure. It's just part of the what needs to be done is the consumer more in the way of consumer education, and there's some things that already are ongoing. For instance, Justice and Oregon State Police and CCB right now do some joint consumer education.
Okay. I'm sorry, I must have this. It seems like to me that, but the education of the training portion of it was dealt with in-house training issues more than it dealt with public training.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you may be recalling a budget note from the last legislative session that instructed the agency to improve its consumer education activities.
Okay.
Chair Butler, we do a lot in that area, but we always could do more. There are still not enough people in Oregon that are aware that they ought to check on the contractor before, see that the contractor is registered before they hire them, and other things that they should do, but just that one area of a lot of problems would not be problems had they gone with a contractor who was registered as opposed to somebody who had a better deal and was saving money but wasn't registered.
And relative to the budget notes from the last budget session, you feel like that you're basically in compliance then with that education portion that was contemplated at that time?
We are in compliance with that, but again, I wouldn't hesitate to tell you that we need to do more, even though we've moved in the right direction, we haven't moved far enough.
And you ever get enough education, in other words? Senator Crowe, you're supposed to respond immediately to that question.
What was the question?
The question is, can you ever get enough education?
Someone reminded me, Chair Butler, the other day that when I talked about the three public announcements that you can get come at weird hours, but they reminded me that the older we get, the earlier we are up in the morning, and maybe if you can get some of those early announcements that we ought to take advantage of. I think it is a point, and I'm going to look further at that.
I think that's probably accurate, that may be the case, that the free public announcements, that I know I hear some weird stuff coming across the radio early in the morning.
We don't want weird stuff, but we want
I'm even going to order a fat whacker most any time. That clapping the two boards together really is impressive to me at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Mr. Chair, you got to stop listening to Howard Stern.
Okay. Are there any questions about this before we go on to work session?
Sure.
Yes, Representative Leonard. Yes.
Well, I have a fundamental question. I don't quite grasp the concept of having a statute on the books that says the construction contractors board shall enter into an interagency agreement with the Oregon State Police. It says the agreement shall provide for, and then specifically says things such as establishing a central intelligence gathering unit, conducting public education and construction contractor fraud, training and construction, coordinating with state and federal prosecutors on an effective method of prosecution, construction contractor fraud cases, supervising case assignment, management preparation, maintaining on-scene supervision, hiring supervisors to coordinate and assist the district attorney with major case file preparations. Those are very specific requirements. They aren't esoteric. They're very specific as to what the legislature intended to have happen. And suggest that we, as a subcommittee of the Ways and Means, would make a decision to not fund what the law requires seems to me to be hard to understand. I don't understand.
Are you familiar, Representative, with the various intergovernmental agreements that between the Oregon State Police and the sheriff's departments and the city police departments?
No, I'm not.
Yeah, there's no financial obligation between them, but they address all of the various issues dealing with the items that are of common interest between those various agencies. And so it's not uncommon to have, and of course it was contemplated, I'm not going to subtract from what the 1989 legislation that was passed contemplated. At the time, I think it was contemplated that Oregon State Police would be brought on board to help with the fraud construction industry. The difficulty that we have here is that there's been abundant testimony and some rather substantial information provided to us through the various hearings that this hasn't worked.
Well, with all due respect, Mr. Chair, you may have had testimony in your office. I heard Mr. Cudell say that he had some problems with it. I heard the Oregon State Police testify that it worked. I don't remember the testimony you're talking about. Nobody has come to talk to me to make a case for it. And my question simply is, I'm familiar with intergovernmental agreements. I mean, we've had a number of them in the fire bureau that I helped to negotiate with other fire departments. What this statute says is they shall enter into an agreement with the Oregon State Police. Not may, or they could, or think about it, or study it. They shall, and it shall include these items.
Okay.
So I'm unclear how we can sit here and make a decision that's contrary to the law.
Well, and the decision to have them enter into the agreement shall still be their opportunity to do so. Right now, issue is presently not being worked out. It hasn't been worked out. As a matter of fact, it's still in mediation and has been so for many months, and I don't anticipate nor see an end to it in the immediate future.
What's in mediation?
The issue between the Oregon State Police and the construction contractors.
I've heard nothing about I know nothing about that.
Well, and those mediation sessions are not necessarily public either. So,
this is information I don't know if the rest of me has gotten this information. I've gotten none of that. I haven't been provided with any of that.
I think there's been information that probably has been shared between Mr. Cudell and our legislative fiscal office. And I certainly have been privy to that as I've gone in and asked about what the status is. That's why we're considering this 60 days later than where we started.
Well, I'm being put in a position today of actually having to vote on this issue to defund a unit that is supposed to protect people that are generally helpless and have been defrauded maybe out of their life savings. I am a little uncomfortable doing that, given what the statute says and given...
So we're not going to...
I feel like somebody thought they had a train going here and just avoided talking to me and maybe other committee members, and I don't like that.
Well,
I'm not going to go along with this because somebody went behind closed doors and made a case with somebody that, yes, this didn't make sense to have this without sharing it with everybody.
Representative Leonard, you certainly have an opportunity to visit with the parties involved. Some of that is probably not information that they would like to have on public record as well. So
we're making a decision like this to get rid of a unit that protects.
We're not going to make a decision relative to the code itself. The statutes are the statutes.
Unfunded. Yeah.
That's right. And it's a funding issue. And that's what we're charged with here. Chair recognizes Senator Trill.
Sort of a number of things. For one thing, I think that if we really are intent upon defunding this operation and closing the operation down, the state police and the construction fraud unit, it seems to me like you ought to get a bill and just repeal the law with the bill, which you can do very easily. The Ways and Means Committee has bills, and you can do that, and you can repeal that particular law. Then it seems to me also, as you look at this, remember that budget notes do not have the force of law. And this is worded like it's the law itself. It's saying is directed to do this and must do this, will develop an expenditure plan, will do all these things as though you're writing a law on the budget note.
Okay, and Senator Crowe, let me respond if I may to that, and that is that we anticipate that this budget note will ask for, and it does in fact direct the Construction Contractors Board to return to the emergency board and give periodic updates, and then once a plan has been developed as to how they will address fraud in the industry, and that may also include the intergovernmental agreement to which Representative Leonard has referred, then at that particular point, having addressed all of the issues that they feel like they've addressed, then they certainly have the ability to come to the budget board, the emergency board, and ask for the funds necessary to fund the additional staff internally, or to fund for a state trooper if they decide to enter into an intergovernmental agreement that would require a state trooper.
I think you're missing my point. But what I'm saying is here that maybe it's just the way this thing is worded. I think you can strongly encourage them to do this without telling them you must do this. Because a budget knows, I don't think we have that kind of authority over them. We can't tell them to do things. We can encourage them to do things, and they know if they don't, they probably will hear about it. But it doesn't seem to me like that we can say to do this. Also, as you know, some of it's going to cost money, and clearly they're going to have to get it someplace, some way. You're going to have some kind of ongoing relations with the Oregon State Police, including the process to monitor referrals, track and report outcomes, including convictions from referrals. That must be expensive. Somebody has to pay for that. State police pay for that, or does the contractor's board pay for that?
Maybe Mr. Fidel could respond to the referrals between local police agencies.
I would just suggest that for a budget note, we water it down and say construction is encouraged to develop a plan rather than a directed plan.
I really don't like to water it down. I'd like to have them, because there is statute, I hesitate to say this is one of the 10 great and glorious
direct statutes to tell them to do this. There's statutes to tell them to run a program.
Well, it asks them to comply with the provisions of the statutory provisions in 701-290 related to the statutory mandate of the ongoing relationship. So we're not asking them to disobey any law. We're just asking to...
No, I know you're not. To disobey any law. It's just that I don't think that a budget note has the authority of law, and I don't think
the emergency board, the e-board at that particular point, has the ability to accept or reject the action and fund it accordingly. Senator Crayola is recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think Senator Shore is absolutely correct that a funding note doesn't have the force of law. And as a matter of fact, we had a decision in that regard recently from the State Attorney General, and it was prompted by a question that I and other folks have asked about budget notes that have been used to redirect funds and unhinge laws that we did pass. I'll point out the budget note that reads, notwithstanding the provisions of House Bill 5015, the following directions are made relative to the budget on the Gorge Commission, which took $240,000 away from the counties and gave it to the commission in the last budget discussion. That was patently illegal, and that's where the direction comes from. The budget note that I see here is they relate to budget directions, and they are particularly appropriate, and have also been drafted and offered by legislative fiscal and checked for accuracy or effectiveness. So Senator Crowe's right. You cannot have a budget note that overturns the law or that has the force and effect of the law. We have seen those in the last legislative session, and they always create a train wreck. This budget note does not fall into that category. So I would suggest that perhaps the chairman needs to move forward with this project.
That's good counsel, and we'll move then to a work session on House Bills 2020, 2056, 5036, and 5037. Ms. Lamont?
Mr. Chair, I believe that we have walked through, on my recommendation, through items 3-5. So the action in front of us now is the recommendation of the chair with regard to eliminating the funding for the Oregon State Police Construction Squad Unit and directing the agency that if they intend to come back with a plan to use those funds, that they should be that their plan should include the issues that were listed in the budget note.
Okay. Now let's see, is yes,
yes, item 3I.
Is that I or D? Okay, I beg your pardon. Is that 3 or 4? I have
my resolution, it's 4.
I'm sorry, I just wanted to kind of wrong spot here. Okay. So 3I is the budget note, which we just discussed. We're in their directed to proceed with some activities dealing with crime and malfeasance, comply with 701-290 under the Order of Revised Statutes, and address specific issues relative to referring and tracking crimes and convictions and outcomes. Any discussion with regard to any further discussion with regard to that note now that we're in work session?
Well, I'm just going to say that I think you're right that the statute requires a construction contractor's board to do those things with the Oregon State Police that requires. I guess if you don't have the funding to accomplish that, that's the way it is. But I expect the construction contractor's board to comply with the statute. That's what was passed and signed by the governor, and that's what it requires. And unless this body repeals that statute, I would expect you to do what it requires of you. And I intend to follow that up to make sure it is complied with.
Okay. Any other further discussion relative to that budget motion? Thank you. Number 5.
Mr. Chair, we have walked down all the way through this budget. What is left is the dollar amount. I guess what I need is a motion from someone on the committee to accept the previous recommendations relative to the budget and adopt the amendment to Section 1 in House Bill 5036, which is $9,850,924.
Okay, Representative Hansen moves the relative to House Bill 5036, Section 1, which is Line 5, that the amount that presently is in there be struck and that we include an amount of $9,850,924. Is there any objection to that?
That's
For the record, Representative Leonard objects. Any other objections? If not, it's so ordered. And then relative to please proceed.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the second part of the recommendation involves the Landscape Contractors Board. My recommendation is first that we approve the current service level, the spreadsheet detailing that. The information that I'm going to be walking through is found on page 3 of the spreadsheet. I'm recommending approval of the current service level. The adjustments within the current service level, as we discussed in our previous hearings, are standard inflation and standard inflation and other adjustments. I'm recommending a reduction in the Attorney General cost of $594 to reflect the Attorney General rate reduction. And then I'm making the following recommendations related to the budget packages, and those are detailed on page 3. Package 100, approved $14,911, that's the total revenues recommended package, for base budget salary adjustments, rent increase, a laptop computer, and per diem for one additional meeting per month for board members. I am recommending that we not approve Package 101. The board can return to the emergency board if additional limitation is needed following the review of the reclassifications. This has to do with the Landscape Contractors Board chair of the personnel cost. If you recall, the personnel that administer the Landscape Contractors Board are actually housed in the Construction Contractors Board. Package 102, do not approve. Again, the board can return to the emergency board if additional limitation is needed following the review of technology needs. That was a budget note and instructions having to do with the Construction Contractors Board request. I'm recommending that we approve a general increase of $18,126, which is a 4.58% increase to the construction contractor's board current service level based on the budget packages that we approved within the construction contractor's board, this being the landscape contractor's board share of those costs. And with those recommendations, then I am recommending that we amend Section 2 of House Bill 5036 to the amount of $428,210.
Is there, having heard the recommendation of Legislative Fiscal Officer Robin Lamont, is there anyone to move that approval of the agency budget?
This is just of the...
this is of the construction of the...
Landscape
Architects. Landscape Contractors Board. State Landscape Contractors Board.
Okay.
It's moved by Representative Hansen that we approve as to Section 2, which is Line 9 of House Bill 5036, a total of $428,210. The prior number being struck therefrom. Is there any objections? There being no objections stated, we'll go ahead and approve that amount.
And then, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, with regard to House Bill 5037, if you recall, and perhaps Mr. Pudel could briefly speak to that.
Excuse me, one second. How are we going to? Are you going to remove the whole 5036 now that it's been amended, or are you waiting to do that? Or?
Well, we could do that.
Well, let's go ahead and 5037 first if we could. Let's so we can just wrap on everything.
Well, but I'm not going to vote the same on every bill, so
okay.
They're not going to.
Okay. We'll move
the bill as amended to the floor.
Okay. We'll go ahead and take then. 2020 and 2057. Those need to go back now that we've addressed the issues. Those will not have to go to the full because we have no fiscal impact on...
Mr. Chair, that's not quite correct. They will need to be moved out of the full Ways and Means Committee.
Even so because they previously had them, they have been referred to.
Right.
So 2020 and 2057, having no fiscal impact, but, a fiscal impact having been ameliorated as a result of 5036, the recommendation of Legislative Fiscal is that House Bill 2020 and 2057 be returned to the full Ways and Means
with a
due pass at no fiscal impact. Is there any objection? There being none, so ordered. And we'll have Representative Ferriola at table.
Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the opportunity to carry both those bills and your compliment by referring to me as representative.
I beg your pardon, Senator.
Not a problem.
Your representative.
So my good friend, your representative.
Senator Ferriola is on full committee. And I need to help carry you.
Representative Jansen, would you like to carry that in the House? Those two that have most. Okay. And let's go then on to 5036. And 5036, at this time, we have amended two different amounts on line 5 and on line 9, as so noted. Are there objections to 5036 going to the full Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation?
I object.
Okay. We have objections stated by Representative Leonard and Senator Trow. Any other objections? Being none, then we'll send that to the full Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. And let's see. Senator Ferry, always get you right there. Would you like to go ahead and take that too?
It'll be a pleasure, Mr. Chairman. All right. I'll make for a lively discussion on the
And I need a health carrier on this.
Health carrier, Mr. Van Hansen, would you like to hear
that? I used to have friends that were representatives.
Thank you very much. Okay, then we move on to 5037 so we can wrap up 5037 policy to the landscape contractors board, state landscape contractors board.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if you recall during a public hearing, Mr. Tudell explained that this is a bill that implements an administrative fee that was adopted in response to the provisions of ORS 291055. There is an attachment to your handout. The fees are related to the home inspector program. Mr. Tudell discussed the estimated revenues and their actual revenues. They are not generating the revenues that they had anticipated and have adjusted their staffing downward as a result. However, the fee bill does need to be adopted by the legislature to continue.
Let's see. I'm looking for a copy of that in front of me here.
Are you looking for the fee bill?
I'm looking for the fee bill itself. I beg your pardon. I have my copy of the fee bill. 5037 provides for the home inspection certification application fee of $50, home inspection certification examination, first attempt $50, subsequent attempts $25, and annual certification is $75. And that's the initial fees being recommended. Are there any objections to the legislative fiscal recommendation and the request? There being no objections to the amounts of amount stated in House Bill 5037 relative to the administrative fees for the construction
contract. Well, it's the
home inspector program of the construction contractors board. There being no objection, we'll go ahead and pass that with a due pass recommendation. The polls waive the name. And Senator Crayoli, what are you doing next, Friday?
Actually, I think it's very hard to get this to
probably
the committee this week. So.
Tacking on your bill.
Okay. Thank you very much.
And again, I need a help carrying
this. This is Hanson. You feel might as well carry him all the day?
Yeah, unless you think it'd be better to have a Republican carrying a fee increase.
Oh.
I'd be glad as long as the committee gets the support.
Absolutely. Thank you, Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Thank you. We'll go ahead and close the...
As long as I don't have to wear a costume or a silly hat.
No, that belongs to another member.
Oh, okay.
Now, Mr. Chair,
we'll go ahead and close the...
Thank you very much, Mr. Dale.
Appreciate your...
Thanks, Mark. He was insinuating that I was wearing a silly hat today.
It just looked silly on the
top. I don't think it was an insinuation.
Jim?
In the halfway part. I'm focused on looking. There we go.
We'll open the subcommittee or the subcommittee on Ways and Means of General Government. And today we are in the public hearing portion of Senate Bill 5514, the Department of Revenue. And we invite Mr. Tarchenko. And anyone else that you would like to have come forward? And we'll go ahead and have Legislative Fiscal Officer acknowledge Suma Glashen with us today, and our clerk today is Jamie Fenn. Ms. McGlashen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've passed out some information to you on the Department of Revenue, and on the top is the Legislative Fiscal Office's analysis that we published at the beginning of the session on the budget, and reading budget. And then there are also three reports, two audit reports on this agency. And I won't go into a lot of detail about these, I'll let the agencies cover these in their previous pages. But basically, one has to do with general and personal income tax controls within the department, around the department system. And the objective of the audit, this is a follow-up to a previous audit, the objective of the audit was to determine if the information processing division has in place a system of control procedures to provide reasonable assurance of preventing or detecting unauthorized or improper modification or use of its data. And what the Secretary of State audit division found was that the department has made improvements in several areas, but there are certain areas in which improvements could continue to be made. And again, the department can address these later, but in summary, it agreed with what the audit division found and also presented some corrective action planning in this report. And then the other audit report is on property tax exemptions. And in this one, the audit division looked for the 95-96 tax year, looked at this area and found that not all property that should be taxed is included on the tax roll. There were some issues with whether or not the exemptions met all the statutory and rule requirements that they were supposed in order to be excluded from the tax roll, and that there was a cost associated with the improper exemption of these properties. And again, I'll let the department address that later in its presentation. And then finally, there's a report as a result of the budget note in 97 legislation in House Bill 2049, the legislature directed the department to conduct a study of the appropriate level of funding for property tax administration. And as a result of that budget note, this report was presented to the House Interim Revenue Committee last November, I believe. And again, when the department gets into the details of its budget, they can talk more about that. So those are all there for you to peruse. And with that, I'll go ahead and turn this over to the agency and let them do their overview. And then we'll have the Department of Administrative Services present the budget. And then we'll go back to the agency and give you more detail on that budget.
Thank you, Mrs. Ashton. Let's go ahead for a brief overview then from the agency. We welcome Ms. Archenko with us, and if you'd like to go ahead and commence, you're welcome to do that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You know the rules of the...
I know the rules, Mr. Chair, and I'm taking a risk because I didn't bring any quarters in my pocket.
We take paper money.
Well, I'll do my very best not to use any accident. If I stand, I'll ask for credit until tomorrow. Good afternoon. I'm Elizabeth Harshenko, Director of the Oregon Department of Revenue. With me today is Deputy Director Tom Brown. We're going to give you a brief overview of the department, and within the time that we have for a public hearing this week, try to give you a sense of our major program areas, some history around our workforce and productivity initiatives, talk to you about our income tax and property tax system, and some of our other programs, some legislation that's coming that will affect our budget and operations, as well as talk to you about our policy package and deduction options. We've given you a notebook. You have lots and lots of white binders on your tables, and this is one of them. It's a picture on the front. And under the yellow tab, where I'll be starting, I'm talking to you briefly now about who we are and what we do at the department. Our mission at the department is to make tax systems work effectively to fund services to Oregonians. And we think it's very important for us to remember that taxes are not an end in themselves, but the means by which the state provides services to Oregonians. And so we remind ourselves of that, remind our staff of that. And as we look at the programs that we're responsible for administering, we're trying to ask ourselves always, how are we going to make those more effective? Our largest programs, obviously, are the personal income tax and the property tax that we work on. Moving to page 3 in the binder, just wanted to show you that the department has it has a connection to a very large amount of revenue, not only at the state level but also at the local level, for the biennium that we are in currently, 1997 to 1999. The personal income tax program alone is expected to produce over $7 billion. The property tax system, even after Measure 5 and Measure 50, still produces over $5 billion in a biennium for local government. And we are involved in many of the taxes in the little the green pie piece there, and the largest of those are the corporation income tax and the cigarette tax. The reason that we wanted to point out the property tax system is really responsible for supporting the work of the counties in administering the property tax, and it is still very important to the state because of the relationship now that the state has with school funding. Turning to page 4 in the binder, we wanted to let you know what our values are, what's important to us at the department. These are values that I think the staff generally feel are very important to them. We did some work a few years ago asking folks what they thought the values of the agency are. High ethical conduct, we feel that because we are the administrator of tax systems, that we have to be trustworthy and trusted by taxpayers so that they can feel confident that if they meet their obligations, we're meeting ours. Operational excellence, we continue to look for ways to improve our processes and systems so that we're doing our work better, more efficiently, more effectively. Taxpayers can count on them. Fiscal responsibility, both how we handle our budget dollars as well as how we handle the revenues that go through our systems every year. Respect for ourselves and others, professionalism and courtesy is very, very important to us, both as we deal with each other in the department and as we deal with taxpayers, as we deal with county taxing officials, the legislature, the rest of the executive branch, with partner agencies, and the public generally. And being responsive to our customers. We need to be able to meet the needs of taxpayers, especially in our income tax system, which relies on taxpayers to do most of the work. We give them a form, but we expect them to calculate and report their tax liability. We need to be able to meet their needs so that they can do that accurately and timely. We have four focus areas in our vision. One is customer service. In that area specifically, I wanted to point out that we're looking for ways to continue to expand the way the taxpayers can file their returns. We have the traditional paper, and as we'll talk to you about a little bit later, we're getting into electronic filing of income tax returns, which is becoming very popular. And in our policy package, we have a proposal for a pilot to try telephone filing for simple returns. We also try very hard to simplify the tax laws for taxpayers through continuous improvement in our forms, instructions, and publications. And we have adopted a benchmark, the Oregon Progress Board benchmark number 36, sets as a target 60% of Oregonians understanding some very basic components of the public finance system by the year 2010. And so we do the best we can to contribute to that effort by including education to Oregonians about the most significant portion of the state general fund, which is income taxes, and where that money is most likely to go, which is to education. And you'll see in some of the materials that we have some of the things that we're doing about that. In operational efficiency, those of you who were able to come on the tour yesterday were able to see that we're working very hard to continue to improve our efficiency, particularly in the processing portion of our operation. We look for ways to improve our productivity through using automation and information systems. We try to take advantage of the ideas that our staff come up with to continue to innovate and be more creative and keep ourselves as a high-performance organization. I think I've already addressed the fiscal responsibility piece, the stewardship of our budget, as well as the taxes that we collect. Our vision around our work environment is to promote pride in the service that our employees are providing. Again, we remind them that what they're doing is enabling the state to provide services to those who need it in the public. Public employees aren't always appreciated, so we do the best that we can to let our employees know how much we appreciate the work that we do. The picture that you see there is from a celebration after we got tech statements out after Measure 50 was passed. We have set ourselves a deadline. It had to be out before the end of December of 1997 and had no fallback plan. So we were very, very happy to have been successful in the partnership with the counties, the assessors, the tax collectors. We had lots and lots of our staff that came in and worked on the project, and this picture is from that celebration. We set ourselves four areas for goals for this biennium and in the near-term future. With respect to diversity, to make significant gains in the diversity of our workforce, and to maintain what we call a welcoming environment, which is one in which we are open to and take advantage of new ideas, new ways of thinking and solving problems, accepting of different perspectives, and always asking the question, why do we do it this way? In the communication area, this goal is around the benchmark, 36, to educate the public. In our workforce, our goal is to continue to reinvest in the gains that we derive from productivity improvements, imaginatively, to help us to achieve our vision. And in the compliance area, we have a performance measure that's related to voluntary compliance, and we want to improve the amount of voluntary compliance indicated by that measure from 87% of the population to 91% by the year 2002.
Question, Mr. Chairman. Under the communication, educating the public for the 50% understanding the tank system, what's the estimate that the current understanding level is at?
The latest benchmark information that came out was right around 20%, I believe, Representative Hansen. And the progress board has been relying on a survey that's done every 2 years to see whether the public is gaining a better understanding. Turning to page 10 of the presentation materials, this is our effort to graphically represent for you our organizational structure. When I came to the department, I came from another state agency, and I had worked with people in the Department of Revenue, and one of the things that really attracted me to that agency is the team spirit in the department, and our management team truly does work as a team, and that's why the circle. In addition to Jim, my deputy, I have four division administrators who may have come into the room. Yes, magically into the room. Representative Hansen, you weren't on the tour yesterday, and they were introduced, so I'd like to just briefly introduce them. Randy Evers is my property tax administrator. Susan Browning is responsible for the personal tax and compliance division. Jeff Ogami is information processing division, and John Scar is business division administrator. And we really do operate as a team in our decision-making and guidance of the agency. 3 years ago, we reorganized the department. This happened right about 8 months before I got there, to realign the way that we work with taxpayers based upon who they are. And so instead of having audit and collections, which were was the old model, we now have the personal tax and compliance division, which works with individual taxpayers, and the business division, which works with business taxpayers. And we found that we're able to better provide service to them based on their needs by organizing in that way. At this time, I'd like to ask George Dunford, our analyst from the Department of Administrative Services, to come up and do his presentation.
Chairman Butler, members of the committee, Ms. McGlashan, LFO staff. Thanks for having me here today. I have to tell you that I've been with DAS now. I've been with the Department of Administrative Services. Now, from my understanding is once you make the error and pay, Can you make the error again?
Representative Krupp runs by a little bit different. It all goes to the American Cancer Society, but as long as you'll tell us what the acronym is, you get two of them free.
Excuse me, members of the committee. Mr. Chair, I've paid, so, and I'm unlike you folks. I'm a man of minor means, I think, so I'm going to do my very best not to make an error. My name is George Dunford. I am with the Department of Administrative Services, Budget and Management Division. I was about to tell you before I made the slip that I've worked there now for almost 4 months, and I think up till today I really enjoyed the experience quite well. So I'll let you grade my performance after I'm finished. I think each of you have a copy of my overview, I think. I'm not going to get into the detail in terms of the operational departments of the divisions of the department, but I will tell you that there are 9 components of those for the governor's budget. And Ms. Hershenko and Mr. Brown will get into that in some depth today and over the course of this week. The governor's recommended budget for 1999 and 2001 has been revised, and I'll reconcile that at the end of this presentation for you. The revised amount is general fund $104,906,024. Other funds $12,971,532. The multi-state tax commission is an other funds non-limited category. It is at $186,544. For total funds of $118,064,100. Positions, 1,048. FTE, that's full-time equivalent, 926.21. Bottom line, the total funds budget for 1999-2001 is a 6.9% increase over the 1997-1999 legislatively approved levels. Some of the important items to highlight at this juncture, I think, are the addition of 2 policy packages, adding a total of 54 positions to the department's budget, the transfer of $12 billion from the senior... did I say $12
million? You said billion.
Oh, if I said billion, I'm sorry. That's $12
million
from the senior property tax deferral program. From the reserves, and if you like, we can get into some detail on that at your pleasure. The department reduces funding for the Elderly Rental Assistance Program by about 6% because they anticipate that there will be fewer qualifiers for that program in 1999-2001. And the governor's recommended budget, as revised, does recognize that the second year of the biennium, beginning July 1 of 2000, we'll have, depending on what happens to House Bill 2139, a hole to the extent that the other funds, which support 29 positions and 14.5 FTE, will not be there. The policy packages that form the governor's recommended are 2. The first one's divided up among 4 divisions. It's the tax compliance package. It is the larger of the 2 packages. It will raise revenue of approximately $8.5 million over the course of the biennium and cost $4.6 million total funds. The second package is that which makes up the large portion of the revised governor's recommended budget, and that basically will raise approximately $5.2 million over the course of the biennium, add 13 positions and 12 full-time equivalent FTE, cost $1.2 million total funds. The other item I'd like to highlight for you, in addition to the property tax assessment and taxation problem for the department in the second year of the biennium, is that we have also, in the governor's recommended budget, removed the provision for the kicker costs. Obviously, in December of 98, the forecast did not anticipate a kicker, the 2% kicker. In March, it did. It is, at this point, a forecast. So I leave it to you folks in terms of knowing that we may have to return to the emergency board for that other funds limitation.
Could be out of money by then, George, so
may not do any good to return to the emergency board.
Mr. Chair, I was told that you weren't a man that really would joke with me very much, so I'll pretend I didn't hear that.
And Representative Krupp's absence, I've got to take it. That's my only opportunity. Please proceed.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. The only technical adjustment that I'll raise is a minor one, to the extent that it's a revenue transfer issue. And the governor's recommended it has $65,259,000 revenue transfer into the department from the judicial department. And I just want to mention to the committee that we'll want to adjust that number to $66,928,319. I'll be happy to take questions if you have any.
Are there questions for Mr. Dunphy? Mr. Dunphy, is that right?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
What's the expected cost for processing the ticker?
The cost, the emergency board authorized $782,757 in 1997. And I presume, and I'll stand corrected by my compatriots here at the table, but I presume it'll be in that neighborhood again.
As I recall, in years past, there was an opportunity to, and this has been many years ago, there was an opportunity on the subsequent year's individual tax return to take credit for the prior year's kicker. That's got to have been 15 or 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever enhances to stop doing that?
Well, Mr. Chair, if I may answer that question, the legislature decided, and I believe it would have been in 1990, was it 97 session or 95 session?
Jim,
95 session, to have the kicker be issued as checks rather than credits. When the kicker was returned to taxpayers as a credit, it was returned to taxpayers who, in the view, I think, of the legislature, hadn't paid the quote, excess taxes or the surplus taxes, because it was going on to the next year's income tax return as a credit. And so people who had paid taxes in the biennium for which the excess or surplus revenue had come, who had left the state, wouldn't get that payment. And so they transformed it then into a check so that it went back to the people who had paid the surplus.
So it was going to be a fairness issue as opposed to just what was expedient.
Well, Mr. Chair, there may have been more reasons than that, but I know that that was one that was discussed that I recall.
That's Christmas gifts. Okay. I wondered at the time what the cost of the cutting of the check, if that was the...
It was about $1 million in the end of the day.
About $750,000 was what it cost us this last time.
Okay. Other questions? Ms. Dunford? Okay. We'll continue then.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I think George is finished. He's leaving the table. Okay, Mr. Chair, just one last bit of information about the kicker. We did go to the emergency board in 1997 for the other funds limitation for those costs, and they come out of the surplus revenues that are being returned to taxpayers. Okay, we're ready to move on to page 12 in the binder and start to introduce you a little more intimately to our major tax program. When we talk about income taxes,
We're talking about two different income tax programs, our personal income tax program, which is paid by individuals, and our corporation income or excise tax, which is a profit-based tax that's paid by corporations. And so if I talk about income taxes, just generally I'm talking about both of those, and I will try to be clear if I'm only addressing the personal income tax or the corporation tax, because some of our information is limited to one or the other of those programs. But generally, the major functions that we perform in connection with our income taxes are to assist and educate taxpayers so that they're able to comply timely and correctly. We process returns and put the money in the bank. And we audit returns and collect delinquent tax payments. For those two programs, the personal income tax and the corporation tax, for 1997 to 99, the estimated revenue, I think based on the March forecast, is roughly $7.7 billion for the biennium for those two programs. Our administrative costs will run approximately $61 million. And our cost-to-revenue ratio is just under 0.8%. We run the full range of activities from what I call the front end to the back end, supporting compliance through forums, education, publications, and instructions. We offer help to taxpayers through telephone and electronic means. We have our staff often goes out into the public to talk to groups. We've participated very successfully in new employer orientation programs to help people who are going into business and are going to have employees what their obligations are so that they can get started doing it right, processing returns and correcting them when they're not right. Locating people who should be reporting and filing and who are not, and auditing and collecting, auditing returns and collecting taxes. On the next page, you'll see a graphic that is from a poster that we've developed as part of our educational efforts. And when I go out and talk to groups or my staff goes out and talks to groups, we take this poster with us, and we've made those available to members of the legislature when we first developed it. If anyone who doesn't have one and would like one or several, please let us know and we'll provide them for you. And our goal was to show people visually of their income tax dollars approximately how much of that dollar is going to the different services that are provided through the state budget that are provided by the state and provided at the local level. Our other major tax area that we're involved in is the property tax system. This is a system where we have a partnership with local tax assessors and tax collectors. Our jobs are to assist and educate them and support their work, both through technical advice as well as policy direction. We have the Constitution directs that the property tax system be administered under a uniform system of state laws, and so we attempt to provide that uniformity through interpretation of the statutes and adoption of administrative rules. We actually perform appraisal functions for all industrial properties, industrial plants that are worth more than $1 million in the state, and all utility property. And that would include, in addition to energy companies, telecommunications companies, the airlines and the railroads, and determine those values and then certify those values to the assessors for inclusion in the property tax roll. We also create and maintain maps, and this is an area that we're quite excited about because it's got a lot of potential, as we talked about in the tour yesterday. We have contracts with a number of counties to maintain their maps for them, their property tax maps, as well as doing updates, conversions from paper to digital, and some other projects. We also administer the timber tax programs. We collect timber privilege taxes and remit those dollars out to local government. The administrative costs for the property tax system, and now the property tax system is producing revenue at the local level. The revenues for this biennium are estimated to be $5.1 billion. The total administrative costs of both the counties and the department will be roughly $145 million, of which $24 million is the department and $121 million is the county. It's very important for us to remember that because of the link now between state funding of schools and local school funding, that property tax dollars that are not collected at the local level can end up at the legislature's door in the form of a request from the schools for funding, which under Measure 50 is required. One of the interesting differences between the income tax program and the property tax program, and one of the reasons I think that our administrative costs can be so low for the income taxes, is that taxpayers do a lot of work in the income tax to figure out what they owe. In the property tax system, the administrators figure all of that out, and all the folks get is a tax bill. So there's more work that's being done by government just to assess the amount of tax due on the property tax side. On the next page, we've tried to provide you that little dollar bill concept again with what services are paid for with property tax dollars.
I noticed it's the same dollar bill, just divided up differently. You didn't seem to change the serial number on it.
Well, no, we didn't, did we? We're trying to be efficient.
I remember the time when I didn't have two nickels to rub together, but this is pretty bad.
Okay, turning to page 16. In addition to the income taxes and the property tax system, we are also responsible for a wide variety of other programs, and we've listed them here for you. The cigarette tax and other tobacco product taxes both go into the general fund, and any of those dollars support the Oregon Health Plan. The timber taxes, as I said, are distributed to local government. Emergency communications tax supports the 911 network in the state. And some of the smaller fees are used to fund very specific activities for DEQ and the Fire Marshal's Office. We're also charged with receiving fines and assessments that are collected by the court, and collecting all of those from the 36 counties and then redistributing those out according to the statutory formula. Under contract, we collect some taxes for units of local government, both TriMet, Tri-County Metropolitan Service District, and the Lane Transit District have contracted with us to administer their self-employment taxes and payroll taxes. We recover...
Senator Troll,
why is it so expensive to administer the Western Oregon Timber Tax?
The Western Oregon Timberland, is that which the one you're looking at?
No, it's called the Western Oregon Timber Tax.
Oh, okay.
It's about the fourth down.
Right.
$3,225,000 administrative cost.
Well, the...
That's your most expensive administrative cost, except, yeah.
Well, in percentage, it's about 4.5%. It's quite a labor-intensive program, Mr. Chair, Senator Troll. In order to distribute the funds, we have to collect data on where the trees were harvested. We have to collect data on, there's a formula that requires a running average of the levies of the taxing units in which the trees were harvested. The tax itself is based on value, and we have to develop the value tables for all the different species of trees that are harvested. And so it's an extremely labor-intensive program. We do have a bill in I believe it's one of the revenue committees, that would modify the distribution formula so that it would not be as labor-intensive. And there's a lot of discussion about what should happen with the timber taxes over the long term and whether we should move fully back into the property tax system or retain the privilege taxes. But it is...
Privilege tax is sort of a southern thing.
The privilege tax is imposed at the time trees are cut, and it's 3.2% of the value for timber harvested from the Western Oregon and 1.6% of the value of timber harvested on the east side.
Maybe if I could add a couple more comments, Mr. Chair, for the record. I'm Jim Brown, the Deputy Director with the Department of Revenue. A couple other responses to your question, Senator Cho. The costs in this particular biennium are slightly higher than they would be in a normal biennium. And the reason for that is we've created, as you'll see later in our presentation, a single integrated tax accounting system. And we've migrated all of our different programs into that system, and then they're year 2000 compliant. This is the biennium where we are migrating both the Western Oregon and the Eastern Oregon severance taxes or timber taxes. So that will increase the cost slightly. Another piece of information that you may be interested in, these costs are general fund costs, but the general fund is reimbursed for those costs outside of our budget from the proceeds of the tax. It's a strange general fund program in that regard. It's unique in our agency.
Our general funds. General funds are appropriated to do this, and then you're reimbursed.
General funds are appropriated in our budget for our administrative costs, and then the general fund outside of our budget is reimbursed from the proceeds of the tax.
That's unique to just the timber tax?
That's unique to, in our budget, the only two programs, Mr. Chair, that are treated in that way are the Western Oregon timber tax and the Eastern Oregon timber tax.
But the both of those timber taxes are very expensive to administer.
So they are.
Cost-benefit ratio is many times more than anything else on the page.
You are correct, Mr. Chair. We've introduced legislation, at least two or three of the last legislative sessions, to simplify the distribution system so that we could dramatically drop those costs, and that legislation is not passed.
Okay, you're down to the other programs. Are there other questions there? Other programs?
The other programs that we administer, two of them are programs in which we pay out dollars rather than take in dollars. One is the Senior Citizen Property Tax Deferral Program, where eligible individuals who meet the age and income requirements are able to defer payment of property taxes on their homes. The state pays the taxes and then takes a lien on the property at 6% simple interest until the property is sold.
There you go.
What's happening to that tax now? Is it used very much, or this property tax deferral?
Mr. Chair, Senator Tro, the Senior Deferral Program during the last year, we paid $12,700,000 plus in property taxes on behalf of seniors, and we had 9,769 accounts that we paid for. You might be interested to know that there is a bill that was passed out of House Revenue last week to expand availability of this program. I think they did two things. One was to make anyone who is disabled and who meets the income limits eligible regardless of their age. And then they also increased the income limit to initially qualify for the program and the income limit to remain qualified for the program so that more people will
qualify.
The limits now, I believe, for qualification initially is $24,500 income per year, and that's being increased to $27,500 to stay on the program. I believe the income limit is you can't have a yearly income greater than $29,000, and I believe that's being increased to $32,000. So there will be a few more people who will be eligible to participate in the program if that legislation makes it through the system.
Get any feel for that legislation at this point?
Mr. Chair, the reports I have were that the committee, the House Revenue Committee members all were very supportive of the legislation, but I don't think it's had a floor vote yet, so I don't know.
I heard take questions on page 16, and I promised you that I wouldn't get very technical and get into a lot of detail, but I do have some questions.
Mr. Chair.
Let's talk about that senior deferral program right now, if we could. You actually indicate that you get an administrative cost of just under $2 million, and in fact, what we're doing is we're paying out The net bottom line on the senior deferral program, do we recoup our costs of at least the taxes that are being paid out?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Actually, this program has a very interesting history. When it started, we needed there was a general fund infusion that was given to get it going. At this time, we have more in repayments coming back from people who are going off the program and repaying the taxes they've deferred than we have in payments going out to the county. For the current biennium, our estimated repayments will be $38,900,000 and some. And our estimated payments out for the biennium, if I'm reading this right, $25,783,000.
That's for the biennium.
That's
correct.
For the biennium, the two-year budget
about
period.
About the same as it was for each of the prior years. The prior year was $12,700,000.
Yes, yeah, so it's holding steady.
So it's holding steady, and now your repayments are coming back in at about $4 million more per year, it sounds like. If that program is enhanced or modified in the ways that have been discussed, and I don't know what possibility that will happen, but if those are enhanced, are you going to have any asset? Shouldn't there be an asset limitation on those programs for disabled or handicapped?
Mr. Chair, I need to confirm this with the program, and I would like to come back to you tomorrow to confirm it, but I believe there is, my memory is saying there's some sort of an asset limit, but I've learned not to rely on my memory too much if it's not things I've just currently looked at. So can we bring that information back to you tomorrow on what the requirements are in the program?
Okay. My recollection is that there's no asset limitation, and that's of concern to me because what happens is that you could have, particularly if we expand this to handicapped or disabled individuals, and I'm not trying to be harsh on them, it's just that I think we'd be surprised at the number of handicapped and disabled that don't need assistance with property taxes, and I would hesitate to disrupt a perfectly good system with a perfectly good moral reason to do what we have done over these many years for the senior deferral for the benefit of folks that may not really have any benefit or need the benefit of any kind of deferral. So,
Mr. Chair, why don't I have my staff put some information together for you about the program so that, because the bill will be coming up on the floor.
I just had questions relative to the most and the least productive, effective, difficult to administer, and compliant of the program. Can I just talk just briefly? And again, I hesitate to burn up time, and we can spend some time on these questions, but what of the state programs, local programs, which do you feel are the most productive of those programs by and large?
Mr. Chair, would you be willing to allow me to defer this question to when we go into these programs during the presentation? Because I have asked my administrator to be able to respond to that.
That would be fine.
Okay. The other programs are the Elderly Rental Assistance Program, which is a general fund grant program, is that right, to very low-income individuals. And then the Other Agency Accounts Program is a collection program where other state agencies that have debts owed to them can assign those debts to the Department for Collection. And we provide two kinds of services. One is what we call our refund offset service. If a taxpayer that is going to receive a refund owes a debt and we know of that debt from the other agency, we will hold back all or part of the refund depending upon what that debt is. The other program is to provide a full range of collection services to try to recover funds that are owed to other state agencies.
Well, let me just jump back now to the local government programs. On the local government programs, even specifically with the TriMet and the land transfer, is there a cost benefit to the state on administering those programs?
Mr. Chair, there's no profit to the state for administering those programs.
But our administrative costs are correct.
We recover our administrative costs. We do it on contract with the local unit, and you know what, I would assume that in order for them to decide they wanted the state to administer the program, that it would be beneficial for them administratively, that the cost would be lower. These programs are measured by a tax base that is very, very similar to other programs that we administer, and therefore very easy to piggyback onto our withholding program for employers and income tax for the self-employed.
Have the assurance that they are being administered cost effectively, and there is no cost to the general fund.
There is no cost to the general fund, Mr. Chair. We administer them as effectively as we possibly can, and I believe that if these units felt that they could administer them more effectively so that they could keep more of the revenue, they would take the programs back.
And if you don't make any profit on them, I guess you could turn back just that easily.
Yeah,
too.
It's just a service that we provide for our actual cost.
Okay. And relative to those programs against the local governments, the issue of collection and enforcement, any difficulties there? Do we have who does the collection?
We collect the money.
So you take care of the enforcement and collection?
That's correct. That's correct. They're programs that are piggybacked on our existing tax programs. So when we collect, for example, for withholding for an employer that's located within the boundaries of one of these two taxing districts, then we also make sure that they satisfy their obligation to them.
They pay all of their liens that are outstanding against them for property or for the income tax, and fail to pay the TriMet tax, you'll aggressively go after them just as if it was owed straight to the Department of Revenue on behalf of the State General Fund.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. Okay, I'd like to turn the presentation over to Jim Brown now to look at the workload and workforce issues.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members. Again, I'm Jim Brown with the Revenue Department. Starting on page 17, I would like to just go through some information that will give you hopefully a historical perspective, both of the workload for the Department of Revenue and for our workforce and some things that have been happening over the last several years. I do want to start by, I almost brought a $10 bill and set it in front of the page because I've been with the Department of Revenue for 28 years and I've been in tax administration almost my entire adult life, and your rule is going to be particularly difficult for me to follow, but I will do my very best, sir, and I will make every effort not to do that. The acronyms are really a part of who we are, and it's very difficult.
You probably have as many acronyms over in your office as any place I have ever seen in my entire life.
I cannot disagree with that.
Probably taking all of those years, hasn't it, Jim, just to catch all the acronyms, isn't it?
Yes, I think there's some that I still don't know, but I think I know most of them, and I will make every effort to not use any of them in this presentation.
By the time you think you know all the words, you get a teenager come along, and then they start teaching you
them. The two major indicators of our workload as an agency mirror the two major programs that we administer, the personal income tax program and the property tax program. Personal income tax, just to give you an idea, this is just number of personal income tax returns that we have coming into the system since 1991. And you can see that steady growth that's occurring there. That mirrors both the population growth in Oregon and the growth in Oregon's economy over that time period. Page 19 is the primary indicator of workload for both us and the counties and the property tax system, and that's just the number of accounts. And if you were on the tour yesterday, you know that accounts grow over time, even though the size of the state isn't growing, as property gets segregated, subdivided. Maybe a property that was 10 acres now all of a sudden is 20 home sites. So you can see there that we've had fairly steady and significant growth in the last 10 years. The next slide on page 20, I think, is probably one of the most important slides in our document. It tells you how many positions, authorized positions, we've had in the Department of Revenue since 1989-91. And you can see it's not only been flat, but it's actually declined after a one-year bump in 91-93 biennium. That was caused by two different items that occurred in that session. One was Measure 5. We got some additional positions to handle some of the complexities due to Measure 5. And then we also got some additional positions to do one of the first revenue enhancement packages at that time. But again, as you can see, the number of positions has been fairly flat, and even with the policy package. Now, the 1,035 on this list is in the governor's recommended budget prior to the adjustment that Mr. Dunford mentioned. So there is an additional 13, I believe, in that second package. So that would take that number to 1,048 if that were all approved. The next page, again, I think is one that tells a very compelling story. On page 21, even though our workforce has been flat, the makeup of that workforce has changed very significantly over the last 10 years. The areas that you can see there, starting with professional technical, you can see that we have more auditors, more revenue agents on the job today than we had in 1989-91. And that's partially because there have been two or three occasions that you've come to us and said, you know, either the governor has recommended a package or the legislature has approved a package to add a few positions, much like the ones you have before you this time, to raise some additional revenue. One of the most interesting lines to me, having been in the system a long time, is the computer professionals, showing we have 28 computer professionals on staff in 1989-91, and today we have 97, growth of almost, actually more than three times. It shows the rapid growth of that technology, and later I will give you some information that shows you the productivity gains that we've realized.
Post that your number of managers has gone from 152 down to 71. How many offices were there with 152 managers?
We have essentially the same number of offices we have today with a couple of exceptions. We have closed in 91-93, we closed our Ontario office, and we closed an office in Corvallis. And then during the 93-95 biennium, we closed two out-of-state offices that did corporation audits of corporations headquartered outside the state. So we closed an office in San Francisco and an office in New York.
Corvallis is in good company.
It had to be the home locations of two people on our subcommittee.
I think Corvallis, Ontario, and San Francisco mentioned in the same
New York.
So it's sort of positive grouping there.
Mr. Chu, you did point out the manager line, and I'd like to just talk a little bit about that. We've done a number of things to try and be more efficient in the department, and this very dramatic reduction in managers is a representation of that. We have flattened. We actually had an additional layer of managers than we had than we have today. We completely eliminated a layer. And in addition, we cut the total number of managers by more than half. We actually have some first-line managers now with as many as 30 to 35 employees that report directly to them. The one I have the most sympathy for is our manager in our other agency account program, because you added criminal restitution a couple of years ago, and he hired about 15 people at the same time, and performance evaluations are done on your merit date. So he has 15 performance evaluations due in 1 month every year. And so we have asked a lot of our managers. We have changed the way that we interact with our employees to a more of a team focus. To people making more decisions, to high-level technicians doing some of the work that managers used to do, and managers doing mostly managing and coaching and counseling and legal things. The other thing that's very significant there is the reduction in clerical staff. You'll hear later in the report some of the things we've done with our computer staff to automate systems. It used to be if you were a revenue agent, person on the telephone collecting delinquent taxes, and you had a taxpayer on the phone and they entered into a payment arrangement with you. They owed $1,000 and they agreed to pay $250 a month over the next 4 months. When you got done with the taxpayer, you hung up and you either got on the phone and dictated to Office Service Center a payment arrangement. You entered that in a paper file in your records. Office Service Center would type up an agreement with the taxpayer to send them to sign and send them payment coupons, type those up and send them. Today, the agent essentially has about 4 or 5 keystrokes on the machine. The account's online. It enters the amount of the payment agreement. The computer automatically sends the agreement notice, automatically sends the payment coupons, and also automatically monitors the payment plan. So the agent never sees that account again as long as the taxpayer meets the payments that they said they would make. Under the old system, again, it would go out. They would look for those payments every month and see if they were made. Now it only comes back to them.
So in this schematic, how do you show that the temporary employees that you have?
In this?
You don't in this one, I guess. But you're talking about your job classification and changing workforce in the next one.
Mr. Chair, Senator Crow, this is our total position count.
Okay.
So it would include...
We didn't include the temporaries, but you don't break them down.
No, they would...
You have managers who are temporary?
Mr. Chair, Senator Crow, we used to have seasonal managers, but we do not, in the processing center, we do not use those.
So is it mostly then some of the professionals and so forth, plus clerical?
Mr. Chair, Senator Trove, the temporaries that you saw in the processing center, which is where 95% of our seasonal and permanent part-time employees are, would fall into that clerical job classification. We have a few part-time professional positions where we have somebody that, for some reason in their life, want to work half-time.
Mm-hmm.
But the overwhelming majority are going to be in that clerical line.
You keep positions vacant so that you can do temporaries? Is that how you do it?
Mr. Chair, Senator Shore, we have a number of part-time positions and a large number of seasonal and temporary positions, primarily in our return processing center. And we do use those positions in some unique ways. Sometimes we have a number of those positions vacant. It might be that rather than bring in 3 people to bank money at a particular time, you're better off bringing in 1 trained person and using that person longer, using them more hours. And so you might have 3 positions, only one of which is filled, but we're using the money to fund this other position for more hours than it would otherwise have. I don't know if that answered your question. It is very confusing, but it's part of, when you met Nancy yesterday, it's part of what Nancy and her managers do to try and maximize the productivity of that center.
Just wondering, you don't keep just an amount of money available, but you actually do it through money that goes to positions to pay for temporaries. Is that the way
you're sure? Wonderful, that's correct.
Yeah.
We're right here on 22. 22, I guess, depicts graphically what 21 says numerically. And we are out of time. Can we pick it up with productivity gains from all that Steve and I want to talk? I mean,
we don't have anything other than this to do tomorrow, I think. So let's do that. Does that work out? Thank you very much. We appreciate it. Have a great day. We'll go ahead and close this session and do it even hour and all. Thank you.